So it was a goal of mine when I, those who are familiar with my classes, even my, I don't like the word sermon, I don't really give sermons, a Dvar Torah, but I try to make them educational. And I don't, I try to show my way of reasoning and the source that I based it on, and really, I'm not laying down the law, so to speak. I'm inviting people to think along with me and check the sources and think for yourself. And that's what Judaism is, to really, ultimately, the objective is for a person to develop the ability. It's the most fascinating thing in the world to study Judaism and to study the sources of Judaism. It's kind of an unknown phenomenon. It's sort of a secret. It's the best kept secret in the world. What the Jews are sitting on, what if you really probe deeply beyond the superficial religiosity and you get into the, you'll see it's a whole philosophy of life covering virtually every area. And but it does take skills, it takes technique, and up to a point you do need a teacher. And that's really my objective, is to share. I'm an educator. Now, one of the most important subjects that we study, studying of Chumash. I think everybody's fascinated by the study of Chumash. We've just come.
Hello.
One of the main subjects that the Chumash the, talks about, of course, is you get a sense of great people. That's one of the main themes. Basically, perhaps you're talking about two groups. You're talking about great individuals. The Torah describes their lives, their activities, and so forth. Then you're talking about a people that's in formation, the Jewish people at large and the deeds of the Jewish people. Those seem, and then of course you have a third group. Who's the third group that you find in the Chumash? The bad guys. Then there's the enemies. The enemies of the Jewish people. I want to focus a little bit. We've just gone through, I'm not going to be doing it right now, we'll come back to it, because I've been heavily involved in the stories of Joseph and his brothers. That's always been a big fascination. I probably have more classes, more tapes on that subject than anything else. I kind of made a career out of Joseph and his brothers. It's always fascinated me, all the drama, all the psychology. It really, even on a rather superficial level, I think when people read it, it really grabs you. And the themes that are depicted there are things that affect us to this day. Sibling rivalry, parental favoritism, and things of that sort. But we'll put that aside for the time being. I want to move on a little bit now, and perhaps we'll come back. We're moving now. We've just been studying the story in Exodus, which is about the formation of the Jewish people. And of course, if you're talking about great individuals, it's pretty obvious, the greatest leader of the Jewish people, Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses. And it's important. The Torah is presenting us with these great people, but it's really very challenging. What would you say is the biggest challenge when it comes to studying great individuals? We studied about Abraham. He's not the first person. I guess the first of the great people, I mean, Noah. Perhaps Noah is a great person, but you really don't get too much information about Noah other than the fact that he saved the entire world. If not for him, the physical world would have been destroyed. And it's not really that clear what he did. Then you move on to people where the Torah spends more time, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. When you study it, I think there's a certain element of frustration. Does everyone, that is, do we really get a chance to know these people? We're used to, today, the whole world is focused on biography. Biography is it, right? I mean, any bookstore, biographies of great people. Everybody wants to read about the biographies of great people. Not because they're interested in finding out their strength, but they want the dirty stuff, the bad stuff, you know, the weaknesses. That's a big attraction. That is a big factor. But the Torah really does not satisfy that type of curiosity, in my opinion. What do you know about Avraham Avinu, about Abraham? What do you know about him? Do you really get a sense that you know the person, that you can identify with him? What he went through? Even when it describes the most challenging task of all, the Akedah. When that's a hard thing for people to grasp, that God would command them to sacrifice his son, his only son, as a test. Of course, we know that there was a test, and God never intended for him to go through with it. But Abraham did not know that. But still, the three-day journey, you'd want to know, what was he thinking? The struggles, the inner struggles that he was going through. You know, all these, his feelings, all those years when Sarah couldn't have a child, and even Sarah's feelings, very, very little. The Torah gives you precious little information of the type of things that we would be interested in. And maybe that's why people don't really read it. Because
All right, you just get a few isolated scraps of information, and it's hard to form a picture. What's the reason for that? Why doesn't the Torah give us more information? Moses, Moshe Rabbeinu, the greatest face-to-face, he went up to Mount Sinai to receive the Torah, and he was the greatest of all the prophets, there's no question about it. We're going to try and construct some kind of a biography, that'll be our task tonight, but the Torah really doesn't give you much. You really have to dig very deeply. I think there's a reason for that. Well, what do you think? Does anything come to mind? The Torah is not about people. The Torah does not believe in the cult of the personality. That's a big, big problem. The whole objective of the Torah, it's basically a book of instruction about how mankind, ought to live their lives in terms of our relationship to God. And the whole idea of hero worship, the so-called deification of individuals, and that you see is a big problem today, even in Judaism, in different branches of Judaism, you find that. There's a boundary line. We have to revere certain people. That's true. Judaism does emphasize the idea that we have to revere teachers because that's important. But it's a different kind of reverence. It cannot pass over the boundary line where the person becomes more than human. And you have that in other religions. You have that in other religions. In all the religions, Christianity for sure. I mean, it's all based upon the deification of a human being. That's the whole essence of the religion, to worship a man. So you see that emotion is very, very powerful. But you see it in Islam as well. You know what's going on around the world now. All kinds of rioting and rampaging and protesting. The fact that they take airplanes and blowing into buildings, and not to mention that they depict their character, how they depict Jews as pigs and monkeys and everything. That's but they have absolutely no sense of tolerance, no sense of humor. If someone has a cartoon about Mohammed, that's the worst crime in the world, and for that you can kill. So you see, all this is rooted in that idea of the deification of people. I'm not saying that it's a good thing to do. I'm saying it's unwise to do these kinds of things. You should respect other people and their feelings about it. I'm not saying that one should do it, practically speaking. But if we've received this throughout the centuries. If someone were to poke fun at a religious leader of the Jews, we'd protest, we'd be upset. I don't think we'd go around rampaging or we'd think it's something you have to kill over. Because we have a recognition that these are people. And you have to have a certain perspective about it. See, the Torah doesn't ever allow us to develop that sense. And I think that's part of it. That it really, we have no interest in Moshe's personal life and his feelings and his emotions and what he liked and how he related to this one. That's not the key. The only thing that's important is certain deeds that he performed. The deeds that he performed. The deeds of Abraham. The deeds, the challenges that he was faced with and how he reacted to those challenges that we can learn from. We can learn from that. So he's a model of correct behavior in certain situations. Another thing is extremely important, and I don't think you'll find this in any other religious, any other religious work. The Torah is unsparing in pointing out the flaws of great people. And there's no other book like that. King David, the sins, even the sins of Moshe Rabbeinu. And God gets angry with Moshe Rabbeinu at the burning bush because Moshe Rabbeinu was reluctant to... God told him he should go. He had a speech defect. It's a very fascinating dialogue over there. The Torah does not believe in the deification of man. The greatness of these people consists in the fact that they can lead us towards a greater appreciation and understanding of what God demands of us. And the only object of worship in Judaism, the only object of worship is God himself, nothing else, no angels, no stars, nothing in between. That is something that Judaism insists upon. So, nevertheless, we should try and study and see what the Torah does provide some information. And we would like to know, who was Moshe and what did he do? What did Moshe do to warrant being selected for this mission prior? We first really encounter him at the burning bush. But by that time, he's not young anymore. Any idea how old Moshe Rabbeinu was at the burning bush? The Torah says openly that Moshe Rabbeinu was 80 years old when he came to Paro. And that was right after the event of the burning bush. He came together with his brother. How old was his brother at the... 83. So if Moshe Rabbeinu was 80 years old and God chose him at that point, there must be some reasons why God selected him. Who was he and what did he do? All right, so we'll pick it up. You know the basic story. He was really, the very fact that he lived was miraculous, because the decree of Paro at that time was to cast all of the male children into the Nile. There's a certain amount of ironies involved that precisely that was the mechanism by which he was saved. That they couldn't hide him any longer. They could not hide him. And they, you all know the story, they decided to put him into the Nile. And you wonder, what kind of a plan is that? They took this little basket and they prepared it as best as they could, and they put the basket into the Nile. What did they expect would happen? I always thought about that. I mean, how long is this basket going to float? And what good will come of that? It seems a strange... It's interesting, the Jews, this is not the first time this happens, because throughout history the Jews were confronted with this kind of problem. How to save Jews, but how to save children from destruction during the Holocaust. Many parents gave the children over to Gentile neighbors, hoping that they would protect them, and in many cases they did. And in many cases, after the war, they did return them to their, you know, Jewish relatives. In my opinion, what's the answer? I mean, that's a good question. What were they thinking? And Miriam, the sister, she was very instrumental in the entire situation, Miriam. She's a silent heroine in the story over here. She stood from afar to see what would happen. So if you want to tackle the story that way, you're going to ask tough questions. Does this seem like a wise plan? I would try to keep hiding the child or something like that, if it was possible. But the answer, in my opinion, is that the daughter of Pharaoh came. The daughter of Pharaoh came, and she saw this basket, and she asked. I'm sorry?
She was a heroine, too?
She was a heroine, yeah. And she was a person of great compassion. So they went and they got the basket, and they opened it up, and they saw the child. And Vihine Nar Boche, he was crying at that time. And she took pity on him. And she said, she knew the story. She knew that this was a Jewish child. She said, this is a Jewish child. And then Miriam came. See, Miriam was strategically placed, and she said, shall I get a nursing mother from the Jews? And she'll nurse the child? And the daughter of Paro said, yes, go ahead. And she went and she called the mother. So providentially it was arranged that the mother of Moshe would actually nurse him. I believe the Torah is not giving you the information, but this wasn't just by chance. They just decided to put the baby in the Nile. Let's see. Go for broke. Because that's not the... Judaism doesn't really endorse such an approach. You have to have seichel. You have to have intelligence. I think that they knew about the situation, that they had done some reconnaissance, and they knew that they knew something about the daughter of Paro. They knew she came down to bathe, and they may have had some insight as to what kind of person she was. And I think that was the idea, that they were going to appeal to her mercy. That's why Miriam hung around to watch. And as soon as this happened, she ran in to secure the fact that Moshe Rabbeinu, after all said and done, was raised by his own mother in the house of Paro. There's a tremendous irony over here. You see the irony, and that is that Paro, whose decree it was his decree to cast every Jewish male into the Nile and thereby destroy the Jewish people, ironically, it was through his daughter that Moshe was saved, that the savior of the Jews was raised in the palace of Paro. That's that's a certain degree of irony. Okay, so now Moshe Rabbeinu is safe. He's being raised, I guess, as a prince in the house of Paro. So what happens next? And the next thing that happens is on page 298, that Moshe grew up. It says it was in those days, and Moshe, this is crucial, because in just a few words, the Torah is going to give us a portrait of some of the qualities of Moshe. So it says that he grew up, but we don't know exactly what that means. We don't know how old he is. Now let's assume he was a prodigy. Let's assume around a teenager, something like that, 12, 13, something like that. We don't know the exact. And he went out to his brethren. Of course, that's a reference to the Jews. So Moshe Rabbeinu was educated in the house of Paro, and he knew about the plight of the Jews. He knew he was Jewish. He had access to his mother, perhaps his sister. He knew he was Jewish. He must have known about the situation of his birth and how he was saved. So he wanted to see what's going on with his brothers, and he saw them in their labors. And then he saw an Egyptian hitting a Jew from his brethren. Now, you learn a lot from this. This pasuk is conveying a tremendous amount of information. What do you see from this? Well, first of all, let me ask you this question. Is there any reason you might think of why it was that Moshe could have been saved in many ways? Obviously, there was divine providence. It was part of the plan of God that Moshe should be saved because of his mission. But do you see anything significant in the fact that he was saved in this way? I said it's an irony, but so what? Is there anything more than just an irony? Was there any divine purpose that Moshe Rabbeinu should be raised in the house of Paro? Was that important in terms of what he was going to do? Yes.
Well, that way he would know the workings of the mind of Pharaoh and be able to know what ways to approach him.
Right.
When he went to court, for example, to warn Pharaoh to let the children of Israel go, he would know in what manner to approach him so that he wouldn't seem like a country yokel.
That's an interesting idea. That's a good idea. That is well taken. You go ahead, Howard.
I've always wondered why Pharaoh didn't just axe him when he came in. And I think it may have had something to do with his familiarity with he knew him before he first approached Pharaoh.
That's a very good question. That always bothered me. Is why did it seems that Moshe Rabbeinu had complete access to Paro. And here he was the leader of this group, and Paro clearly wanted to put down that insurrection. And why didn't he just kill Moshe Rabbeinu? He could have killed him at any point in time. We'll leave that question. We'll come back to that question. But Howard is suggesting that it has to do with the fact that he actually, you see, even in a situation of strife and animosity, the fact that Paro had a certain connection, may have had a certain sympathy for him. Right? Is that what you're suggesting?
Yes.
That's a very good suggestion, except there's one problem with it. Yeah.
Now, if Moshe is 80, it's not as likely it's the same Paro.
It was not. It says clearly before Moshe returns from Midian that the original Paro died and was succeeded by a different Paro.
Yes, but didn't he grew up in the house?
So you want to say that other... Well, you have to... It's possible.
He played with...
But, they were kids. They played together.
Maybe he was his babysitter.
It's possible, but what I think, though, is that... And this has been pointed out by some of the commentators, it's not just my own. I think it have many reasons. It's multifaceted, but you got to look for the basic reasons. First of all, by being raised in the house of Pharaoh, Moshe was saved from something which affected all the other Jews. And that is the development of a slave mentality, which is something which holds a person down. And the whole story of the Exodus, freeing the Jews from Egypt, was not just the physical removal of the Jews, that's part of it, but the most debilitating phenomenon is the development of a certain slave mentality, a certain sense of insecurity. I think we can all relate to that. And it's something which does affect the Jews from time to time. The question is, part the design of God was to liberate them. That's the idea of liberation, to liberate them from a slave mentality. Whether that was really achieved, it depends on our free will. God gives us the opportunity. The question is, even today, are we still troubled? Are we still haunted by a certain sense of inferiority in our relationship to other people? That's a good question. But Moshe Rabbeinu did not suffer from a slave mentality, as you will see. He was a completely independent person because he never experienced slavery. It's very, very difficult. And for people who do go through any kind of oppression and enslavement, even if they should become free of it, and even if they should go emerge from it and go on and develop, people can do that. But it does have certain scars. And you will see, if you have certain psychological insight, you can see what people are affected. They're lacking a certain self-confidence. And perhaps there is a certain type of defensiveness, a certain insecurity that will always remain with them. It's subject, it can be removed. You have to, if you have the courage to face it. I mean, most people in that situation deny that they have the defect, and because they deny it, they will never really acknowledge it and work on it. Moshe Rabbeinu was free of that. The second important thing of being raised in the house of Pharaoh, this is important, of course, our concept of a prophet. Our concept of a prophet is not just someone who's a good person, a righteous person, but he has to be the most advanced, mentally, intellectually, in terms of knowledge. As the Rambam explains, the prophet is on the highest level of intellectual development, and he's a master of all branches of knowledge, such as are available at the time. So Moshe Rabbeinu had access. Being raised as a prince in the house of Paro, he had access to, you know, Egypt was a center of learning and knowledge at the time. So he had those two qualities, which are absolute preconditions for an individual to be a prophet. That is, he can't have, it's very difficult, he can't partake of any kind of a serious mental defect, a psychological defect. Although he did have a physical defect, the speech impediment. The Rambam talks about that. He had a speech impediment. But the speech impediment was such that it did not prevent him from reaching the level he had to reach. That was more of a practical political problem in dealing with people. But God instructed him that he'd be able to overcome it. That's part of the whole debate that he has with God. The real reason, one of the main reasons, not the only one, that Moshe resisted accepting the mission had a lot to do with the fact that he had a speech impediment. And he couldn't see how it would be possible to negotiate effectively without the eloquence, articulation. But here we see the greatness of Moshe Rabbeinu. What do you see? What is now, given this background, what does 11 tell you about Moshe Rabbeinu? What kind of person he was? There's one word that's repeated twice. Hint, hint. There's one word. Always look, see, I'm going to point out little techniques. The Torah does not repeat words. There's usually nothing superfluous in the Torah. So be sensitive to the formulations over here. You'll see that a number of times tonight. There's one word there.
His brethren. No matter how...
Which is mentioned twice.
Right. No matter how connected he was to the royal family in Egypt, he always reached out to his fellow Jews.
Yeah, he was concerned about the situation of the Jews. And he really didn't have to be. That's also important. You see how relevant these issues are. When Jews reach high places, very often, it's a question, you know, a lot of people have a question. If a Jew is running for high office, some people are reluctant to vote for him. I'm not going to say who. But some people are reluctant to vote because of this thing, whether it's justified or not. I mean, it's a consideration that there's a certain sense that sometimes Jews may not be as forceful in standing up for Jewish rights, in standing up for Israel. May not be as a Gentile. Because psychologically, he may feel that he has to demonstrate that he's not just out for Jewish interests. He may have to go the other way. Because people will accuse him of being concerned about the Jews too much. That type of thing. Whereas someone who's not Jewish doesn't have that problem. Moshe Rabbeinu had every opportunity to separate himself from this whole problem. It wasn't his problem. He had been saved. He was in the house of Pharaoh. Nevertheless, first of all, he was concerned about justice. When it says that he grew up and he went out to his brothers, it didn't just mean I want to see what's going on. It means he was studying the whole issue of justice and injustice. And then he wanted to see for himself. The pasuk tells you at this point when he went out to his brothers, which means that he retained his identification with them, even though it was not obviously profitable. They were in a lowly situation, and he was with the king. He didn't have to. Nevertheless, that didn't cause him to break his identity. They were his brothers, and they were suffering. But he wanted to see. It's interesting. Maybe that's the amazing thing. He wants to see. Well, how did it come about? Is it the fault of the Egyptians? Or maybe it's the fault of the Jews. We always have a knee-jerk reaction. The Jews are always right. The other side's always wrong. Here, Moshe Rabbeinu wanted to study the phenomena. So listen to the pasuk. It says, "Vayarbis v'losam." He saw them in their labors, and he saw an Egyptian smiting a Jew, me'echa, from his brothers. Now, here is a simple technique. You must stop and ask a question. Why is it repeating that word? Don't we know? It already told us that he went out to his brothers. We already know that he's Jewish, so obviously his brothers are Jewish. So that last word, a Jewish man from his brothers, is clearly superfluous. What's it telling you? What can you learn from that? It's telling you something very, very fascinating. It's one thing to be concerned about your brothers, to regard them. They're in trouble, Israel, whatever. You always hear stories. So at this point in time, you identify with them, they're your brothers. But let's say you decide to go out and you take a look. He takes a look. And now there's a crisis. He has to make a decision. This person is in danger. And is he still my brother? That is to say, am I still going to get involved? That's a whole different story. To get involved and to fight and the consequences. That for that, That already is a different story. For most people would say, look, I tried and all that, but you expect me to get involved in this? I can find... When is he... Now that he's in danger, he's in serious danger, and you're called upon to do something, is he still your brother? I know. So what... This is a crucial thing. In spite of the fact that he was in big, big danger, and there was nothing in this for Moshe Rabbeinu except trouble, he was still his brother. That's what it's telling you about. The greatness of Moshe Rabbeinu. So what does Moshe do? And tell me what you think. Did Moshe do the right thing? Believe it or not, Moshe's been criticized for this. So he looked, Vayifan Kavachal, he looked all around, and he saw that there was no man. All right, there's many, many meanings, deeper interpretation. Plain shot, plain meaning is that he didn't want to be seen, obviously. He saw that there was nobody around. And he smote the Egyptian, and he hid him in the sand. He buried him. He buried him in the sand. It seems to me, based upon certain Rashi in the commentaries, this wasn't just a case where somebody gave somebody a whack and then Moshe just lost his cool and he couldn't take that. That wasn't the case. The way the Hebrew describes it, it's in the present tense, that he saw that this Egyptian, and then the rabbis bring down some more information, that he had a reason, he had a motive. He was trying to destroy this Jew. That's what he saw. So therefore, if you look at it that way, he had to defend him. It was a matter of life and death, as far as the Jew was concerned. So I would imagine if it was a case where, you know, one of the Egyptian officers just belted him, but that was it, just a bang, and that was it. He wasn't trying to really harm him or destroy him. I don't know that Moshe would have reacted. Because then you got to think it over, what are you going to gain? But he had to act because it was a matter of saving a life. And this is a fundamental principle of Judaism. And you see the greatness of Moshe Rabbeinu. That action is extremely important. That there's a very serious obligation over here. In fact, in my opinion, had Moshe not acted, he would have been in violation. They didn't have the 613 laws. But today, for example, in Judaism, the world at large has this concept of a good Samaritan. That is, if a bystander doesn't do anything. You remember the famous case of Kitty Genovese years and years ago where she was screaming and nobody, people heard and nobody wanted to get involved. So if somebody gets involved, it's a good Samaritan. In Judaism, there's no such thing as a good Samaritan. It's an obligation. That is, if you see a fellow being, a fellow individual in jeopardy, you're not allowed to just hide from it. Thou shalt not stand idly by the blood of your brother. So if a Jew's in trouble... If she was drowning, being attacked, you must jump into the situation. However, that's only if you can swim. No, I'm serious. The law only demands two things. You don't have to give up your life. If you're going to get killed, you don't have to give up your life to save another person. The question is, to what extent do you have to jeopardize yourself? That's an interesting question. But you can't stand idly by. So you have your cell phone. I mean, at the least. If the least you can do is call up the cops, then you have to do that. If you can offer assistance, if someone's drowning, you throw a rope. You're not obligated. If someone is choking, you should know that if you know the Heimlich maneuver. That's why everybody should know it. So Moshe Rabbeinu over here, you see another thing about Moshe Rabbeinu. What else do we see about him? Tell me some more about Moshe. We're learning a lot about him. He was an extremely courageous individual. Extremely courageous, and guess what? He was a fighter. He knew how to fight. This required tremendous courage. We'll soon see he paid a dear price for this. So Moshe Rabbeinu was a man of justice who believed, he was not a pacifist. In the great tradition of the patriarchs, Abraham, I pointed out that Abraham was not a pacifist. In fact, Abraham was a military genius, as we studied the Parsha, where he goes in to rescue his nephew with 318 men. And Moshe Rabbeinu, that's the tradition of Judaism. That Judaism is absolutely opposed to pacifism. We don't glorify war, but we certainly believe that it's obligatory to be capable of self-defense. So you see a man of great wisdom, a man of great justice, a man of great courage, and the fact is that he's connected to his lowly brethren, even though he's in a situation where he's freed. He's absolutely freed from the obligation. Okay, but did somebody once say that no good deed ever goes unpunished? Yeah, I'm sorry, Saul. Judaism does not... We don't believe in that the Jews are superior to non-Jews or that we have a right to mistreat non-Jews at all. I don't think Moshe looked at it that way. To the contrary, you see later on, when he pleads for the Jews by the golden calf, one of his arguments to God is, you shouldn't destroy the Jews because What will the Egyptians say? So you see, he was concerned about the Egyptians, that the Egyptians also should have an opportunity to know God. But it may be correct. Yeah, that was the sin of the Egyptians, that they dehumanized the Jews and they mistreated them that way. All right, let's continue now. It gets interesting. So he goes down on the second day. Now he sees two Jews. And there were two Jewish men were fighting. Okay? And you can see from this, it's always more difficult to deal with Jews than it is to... So he said to the wicked one, Lama saka reyecha, why are you hitting your friend? See, this was... There's obviously a deeper meaning over here. It's always bad, it's always wrong. To hear... You see the difference. Moshe Rabbeinu smote the Egyptian. Yeah, that was legitimate. That was a legitimate thing. Here, it's illegitimate. You're just hitting someone. So, he said, the one he spoke to. And also, he had the courage to confront his own people. Again, the love of justice. Who made you into a man, a ruler, and a judge over us? Are you thinking to kill me, just like you killed the Egyptian? Ooh, I thought Moshe looked around. Isn't that right? Who saw Moshe did it? How did this guy know? Do you intend to kill me just like you killed the Egyptian? So he's rebuking him for killing the Egyptian. It's amazing. Who criticizes him? His fellow Jews. Are criticizing him. It was wrong to kill the Egyptian. What right did you have to kill the Egyptian? So it says that Moshe was afraid, and he said, behold, the matter is known. This word is loaded with ideas. Question is, how did anybody find out?
The man was being hit told someone.
That's the amazing thing. That's the only thing that makes sense is that Moshe Rabbeinu was brought down by the very individual that he saved. Because it says there was nobody there. If there was somebody there that he didn't see, the Torah would point it out to us. The point of the Torah, you have to know, is telling us that there was nobody there. That's the point. Otherwise, we don't need to know. So Moshe Rabbeinu was careful. He didn't want to get caught. Also, those who say that he was doing it to inspire the Jews to fight back, that's not the case. He wasn't doing it. He did it to save the Jews' life. He didn't want it to be discovered. But apparently, it's an amazing kind of a thing. That the individual himself that Moshe saved put him at risk. He went and he told. And he put Moshe Rabbeinu at risk because that's what he's saying. These guys who were fighting apparently knew. And they were condemning Moshe. Who were you to be a judge over us and even over the Egyptian? So Moshe said, I see that the matter is known. Now the rabbis say that there's deeper meanings. Practically speaking, I know that Paro knows that I'm in trouble. But he said it has a deeper idea. Behold, it's known. What's known? There's a beautiful Rashi in this. Rashi says, now I know something that's been troubling. See, Moshe was studying the... Remember I said before Moshe was studying the enslavement? Before he came to conclusions, I'm serious, he had to understand it. And he didn't know why it came about. Why were the Jews? Why the Jews of all the peoples fell into the situation? He says, now I know. Now I know. So Moshe Rabbeinu came to the realization that the Jews... in one way or another, were responsible for it. That rather than stick together against the common enemy, that there had been a problem, that the Jews were blaming Moshe. This is the, what right do you have to interfere? There's a system. The Jews, on some level, had come to accept the enslavement as being, that's part of the law of the land. Part of the law of the land. And who are you to challenge the law of the land? And then Moshe said, that's the mentality? That rather than stand up and fight back, they're fighting me? He says, now I see. And this troubled Moshe later on. This is something that troubled Moshe. Did the Jews deserve to be redeemed? As a result of the fact that they had become corrupted to a certain extent. Alright, so that's phase one. We have one further incident to discuss. The Torah really provides us with two incidents. This is a fascinating incident. And now we get to see some of the qualities of Moshe. Of course, what was the greatest quality of all? If I were to ask you, just take a little bit of a pause before we go on to incident two. What's the greatest quality of all that Moshe possessed that warranted that he should have been the leader?
Faith.
What's the greatest quality? You've read the Chumash.
He was 40 feet tall.
He was, exactly. The most significant quality of Moshe is the humbleness of Moshe, is precisely the question, who am I to go to Paro? That he did not think that he was qualified. And that's why we always, ideally, it's very, you know, very few people that have that degree of humbleness today. But ideally, the major qualification of someone who would be a leader is humbleness. An individual who doesn't believe that he's qualified to be the leader. As opposed to someone who really feels, a person feels that he's the one, that he can do it, then that itself is a problem. A person with an ego problem. Let's look at the second incident. There's one more incident, and apparently this is extremely important to understand why Moshe was chosen. So it says that then, of course, now 15, Paro heard, so they snitched on Moshe. He was brought down by his fellow Jews. Tragically, that happens from time to time throughout history. Jew against Jew. And they sought to kill Moshe. And Moshe ran from Paro. And he dwelled in the land of Midian, and he dwelled by the well. Okay. Now, Ulachoin Midian, and to the Kohen. Kohen is, we use the term Kohen. It's not used in the technical sense. The Kohen is the one who, from the tribe of Levi, who does the service. He was not Jewish. The term Kohen is translated priest. It means he was a religious leader. Okay, Kohen, he was the Kohen. He wasn't Jewish. Well, there really weren't Jews in those days. It was before the Torah was given. But he was a religious leader of Midian. He had seven daughters. And they went, and they drew the water. And they filled up the troughs. Now, that was quite a task. They'd have to carry the water and fill up the watering wells and water their sheep in order to water the sheep of their father. Okay. Why is this story so important? But we'll soon see. And then the shepherds came and drove them off. Ah. And Moshe arose and he saved them and he watered the sheep. Superficially, it seems that this incident is pretty similar to the first one. In both cases, interestingly enough, it's not depicting Moshe in terms of his brilliance, in terms of his knowledge, although we know that, but it's really depicting him in terms of his pursuit of justice and saving the oppressed. That's a key factor. But it seems to be pretty much the same thing. In both cases, people are being oppressed, and Moshe stands up, tremendously courage, and also we see how powerful he was. Where he drives, this is a gang, this is not just one person, the shepherds. So what are the differences between the first case and the second case? What are the differences? Is it just another incident of Moshe Rabbeinu, the hero, coming into town?
He's talking about his non-Jews.
Very good. In the first case, a key element was the brothers. We mentioned that his connection, his solidarity with his brothers is mentioned twice. But what about people that aren't his brothers? These are strangers.
Yeah, right.
This is a case where it's really strangers. And certainly one could say that...
Didn't he end up marrying one of
them? He did end
girls?
Up marrying them. See, I knew so that Avril was going to be there. I don't believe that he did that for that reason.
As long as there's a well, there's women that get married.
It is true that as a result of this, he got a wife. But I don't think... In all honesty, we have to study very honestly. It may be tempting to say that. There's no indication to me that Moshe Rabbeinu was doing it for any ulterior motives. As the story develops, it was Yisro's idea. That the girls came home early, and Yisro questions them, why did you come home early? And they tell him over the story, and he rebukes them. How did you let the person go? So Moshe Rabbeinu did not follow up. If that was the case, if he had any interest, he would have managed to come home with them. He didn't. And the girls were amiss also. He rebukes them. He says that a man did a favor for you. You have to invite him for a meal. But also the term that he uses in Hebrew does indicate that maybe there's a shidduch over here for you too. This is, see, Yisro recognized quality. Not having seen Moshe, this is an unusual kind of a person that would do a thing like this. That's a strong word. Moshe got up and saved them. After all is said and done, they weren't in any danger. They weren't being hit upon. They just wanted to take their turn at the church. They wanted to drive them away, take the water. So what would happen? They'd come back. So it was wrong what they were doing. But the term that Moshe got up and saved them is a very strong term. Yeshua. We use that word in Hebrew. It's a Yeshua. When we talk about a Yeshua, we mean a salvation. Translated literally, the word
Vayoshian would mean he saved them in the sense of a salvation. What's the big deal? If they're all said and done, all right, it's an injustice. But they weren't being threatened. It was different than the first case, and that's very crucial. In the first case, somebody's life was in danger. The Jew was being killed, as we said. In this case, all right, so they were going to lose their turn, and they'd come back. It's not fair, but these things happen. The question, however, is, if you're going to approach this in a strictly logical way, Moshe Rabbeinu was a great individual, and he wanted to save them from the danger. But like sometimes you'll stop, you'll see someone is in danger, and you'll intervene, you'll save them, and then they'll go back. They'll do that was their job. That would have been enough. What was the reason? Why did he didn't have to? They were quite capable of watering the sheep. There's no indication that they were so traumatized that they couldn't do anything, and that's why he did it. That's no indication. It seemed that that would have to be. The way we would approach it is Moshe Rabbeinu was a man of great thought, great sensitivity, great understanding. And I don't think he's going to... Not a person would waste his time either. That's something you have to figure. He was busy studying. These were the years of his development. Many, many years had passed. And he was involved in study, in understanding.
Where did it say that he was studying?
It doesn't say it, but we have to make the inference from other things. I'll have to show you. From other things. But why would he waste his time? That would be a waste of time. It would be, for example, let's say a woman is doing whatever in the house. She's ironing, she's cleaning this and that. And then you pass by and there's somebody that's trying to break in. So you're a good Samaritan, whatever you want to call it. Or you're a good Jew. So you run in and you confront the criminal and you save the situation. And then you call the cops and they haul him away. So now, she thanks you. So we say, okay, and now let me clean the house for you too. I mean, it's like, I know you'd like that. But what's the point? But it wouldn't make sense. It would be illogical. A person should operate in a logical way. You did your thing. Now she's okay. Assuming she's okay, she'll go back and she'll do her work. There's nothing that demands it. So that if it doesn't make sense, you got to be suspicious of chesed sometimes too. Sometimes people do more than they have to do and you wonder, what's the reason for it? It's enough already. Now there's a reason why he did it. He did it on the basis of an understanding. It wasn't a chivalrous type of thing to do, but Moshe Rabbeinu was practicing compassion and justice. So there's two levels of justice. You have to understand, when a person, I think we can relate to this, when a person suffers an injustice, there's two aspects to it. First of all, it's practical. Practically speaking, let's say, if somebody... You get pickpocketed, okay? So then practically, let's say they stole your wallet, whatever. There's the practical consequences. I'm saying he analyzed things. This will show you that he thought about things. And I think we can all identify with it. Now, sometimes someone will pickpocket and it'll be nothing, a dollar bill, whatever it is, okay? So you don't care. But it bothers you. It still bothers you. Because it's an offense to your dignity as a person. It's a breakdown. That's why if a person's house is broken into, it breaks down your whole... It's a violation of your rights, your dignity as a person. So there's the practical aspect of it. Sometimes the practical aspect is not that big a deal. They may break into your car and they got nothing. But the fact that they've broken it gives you a certain anger because they're treading upon your rights as a person. So there's a psychological wound as well. So if Moshe Rabbeinu had merely intervened, that wouldn't have been personal to restore their personal feelings. That would be, he's an individual, then like a policeman. There's got to be justice in a society. It doesn't mean he was doing anything personal for them. So Moshe Rabbeinu realized that. In the first instance, he acted to right the wrong, the objective wrong. But then he realized that if he left at that point, justice means to restore everything that's been lost. They recognized that there was a violation of their importance as people. They drove them away. They treated them like dirt. There was a violation of their importance as people. So then he wanted to do that. That he was doing specially for them, to show that he cared about them, that their life was important, that they weren't insignificant people. That was something which he did from thought. That shows you the difference. That's Moshe Rabbeinu. It wasn't just an emotional reaction. Let me help you. He did it out of thought. If there was no reason for doing it, I'm not sure that he would have done it. Because you could be nice. I mean, so you could spend your whole day going around doing favors for people. That's not the way the system works. Person needs something, I'll help you. But that's it. You don't need any more. Then you go, they needed that. Because that was to restore their personal sense of dignity. Avi?
Good point. It's being pointed out that you see that Moshe Rabbeinu had a love of justice. And it doesn't. There's no indication that he was doing anything to get anything in return. He didn't have to do anything. We'll soon see. I'm going to ask what I consider to be a very, very strong question. Did he act intelligently in this case? Should we do this? Is this the first case? But Moshe acted purely because of a love of justice per se. And it's clear that he did not. It doesn't seem that he had any desire to get anything in return. Because he just, they didn't even thank him. It would seem they went home, and he didn't follow after them. I mean, he didn't try to exploit it. He didn't ask them for a meal or anything like that. He just did what he had to do, and when it was over, he went back to whatever he was doing. We're supposed to learn from Chumash, and we're supposed to emulate, and we're supposed to apply it to our life. So we're trying to study it and apply it to our life. And you can see there's much here that if we uncover it, that's very relevant to everything is relevant to our lives. But the overall behavior of Moshe in this case, is that the way, should a person act that way? Does this make sense? What is the biggest difference, practically speaking, between the first case and the second case? In the first case, it's one-on-one. We don't believe in blind faith. You just jump into a dangerous situation and have... Judaism completely opposed to that.
And you're protecting your own.
You have to know what you're doing. You're protecting... as far as your own is concerned, we said that Moshe Rabbeinu was concerned with all human beings. They have rights. However, isn't there anybody will tell you, no matter how strong you are, Moshe was a good fighter, that's obvious. But isn't there a difference between taking on a gang of shepherds? Isn't it much more dangerous? Isn't it much more dangerous, it seems to me, even if you're a great fighter? Like, who was in that guy in the movies that takes on a...
Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah, Steven Seagal. He was Steven Seagal. Yeah, 25 people. Right? What was the battle over altogether over here? Just some water? I mean, let's face it. What are you supposed to learn? Let's say you're teaching this to your kid, and we should emulate Moshe. So you mean to say that if you see that someone's being picked on, and it's you, just you yourself, you should try and help people. But let's say it's a gang, a group of guys, and they're picking on one kid. Are you and what's it all about? After all said and done, this question was raised before. What was the big salvation? Worst case, so it would be a delay. We've all been subjected to this. We've all been to cases where you cut off the line, where you're you suffer certain injustice is going on all the time. There's no question about it. Injustices are happening all the time. So you mean don't we make a distinction? Sometimes isn't it wiser? Are you going to start a fight? Sometimes you're not. You get caught up on the road, this, that. So sometimes you see like who the people are. Maybe you shut up. Whatever it is, you'll. What would be so terrible after all is said and done? What would have been so terrible? It's only a matter of water, so they'll be delayed for a couple of hours. It's like an injustice. Let's say a kid is in a basketball. Everybody's waiting for their turn to play ball, and this kid gets picked on and he gets pushed aside to the back of the line. So you have to wait another couple of hours. All right, so if you're a person with influence and they'll listen to you, fine. It's an injustice. But does it pay to start a fight? And here it's risking death. A guy can get behind him and throw a rocket. I mean, you're always taking on a gang. Anyone that's been involved in fighting. In this crowd, there's no one looks like they're a fighter over here. Jews don't, they go take it a lawyer.
No, they fight.
Moshe should have gotten a lawyer and sued the shepherds. That's what they would do today. But why would he do that? That's my question. If you take a look at what the daughters said to their father when they came home, this too will confirm basically our points. It says they came home, this is on 18, and he said, why have you come home so early today? And they said, an Egyptian man, Hitzilanu, saved us. That's a pretty strong word. From the shepherds. As though he knew about the shepherds. Something was going on. From those shepherds. And also, but you see how they appreciated the fact, and he also drew the water for us and watered the sheep. That confirms also that the drawing of the water and watering the sheep was very important to them. You see how they, and also, that's not something that we expected. He did that as well. So of course then he gets upset. Well, a man like that, you don't invite him. However, Rashi helps us out very important because it's in a word which everybody will overlook. You will not know the significance of any word until you put all these pieces together. It introduces us by telling us what. Who was this person? L'kohen Midyan. He was the priest. The priest meaning he was a religious leader. And what does that have to do? Who cares? What does it have to do with the whole story? What difference does it make? Would it make a difference if he wasn't a religious leader? Now, Rashi points out that this man was Yisro. Yisro was a very, very special person. And also, he had a very close relationship with Moshe Rabbeinu. What kind of religious leader was he? So what does Rashi say?
He renounced idolatry.
That was a very, very important thing. The entire world was steeped in idolatry, and apparently the people of Midian, he was similar on a certain level to someone like Abraham, who separated himself and gave up idolatry and recognized the true God. But you know what happens. What happens when a person does that? Just like Avram, you have to pay a price. And they turned against him. So take a look at what was the reason. Was it just a bunch of bullies who wanted to get the water and didn't want to wait? They were getting, take a look at what Rashi says. That
ostracized him.
Take a look at 17, Rashi. Those Vayagarshim, the shepherds came and drove the Bipnei HaNidui. That is to say, that they put him, they excommunicated him.
Yeah.
There was a whole plot to punish him, to excommunicate him. They excommunicated him. So therefore, when the girls, so they had a big problem. When the girls came, the shepherds would come and drive them off. Not to be bullies, but it was part of their religious persecution because they had renounced idolatry. Now, in line with what Avi said before, by the way, it doesn't. When you read the story, it seems like Moshe runs away to Egypt. He just comes to Midian and he can barely sit down. No, this takes place many years later.
60.
Apparently 60 years later, because even if, we're not sure if he was 20 at this point when he left Egypt or 13, but he was 80 when he came. So it means, Ramban explains, he traveled to many lands running away before he could even settle because he was afraid that Paro could get him. And finally he settles in Midian, and he settled by the water. So he was familiar with the situation over there. So now we see that this wasn't an ordinary situation. This wasn't an ordinary situation of girls, of people being taken advantage of because they were weaker. This had to do with the fact that people who were striving to give up idolatry and to serve God were being persecuted. That's what the Jew stands for. The Moshe Rabbeinu represents the Jewish people stands for this principle. The whole founding principle of Judaism is the recognition of God. Here, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And that all people, that's our mission, that all people who abandon falsehood and come to a recognition of the truth, we have to help them, we have to work with them, we have to defend them. So that's what it was about. It wasn't about water, that wouldn't have been an issue. But the fact is that as a result of being mistreated, there's a danger that they'll give up the truth and they'll go back to idolatry. So Moshe Rabbeinu has an obligation to put his life on the line to save them from idolatry. That's why he... Now again, it was more danger, but you also have to assume that Moshe Rabbeinu was a powerful individual. He knew how to fight. I do not believe that he was someone who just jumped in there and thought God would help him. He had to defend himself. And Judaism believes in self-defense. So we don't know the exact. Clearly there's a risk. Whenever you take on a group of people, there's a risk. But Moshe Rabbeinu in his own mind decided that it was a risk worth taking. But if you ask why bother taking a risk over something which is trivial, the answer is it's not trivial. There's two kinds of injustices. There's a technical injustice, as I said before. It's an injustice if you get pushed out of the line to the back. But the ultimate stakes, in the ultimate scheme of things, it doesn't really make that much difference. If that was the case, in my opinion, then Moshe Rabbeinu would not necessarily have entered. But this was what I call a philosophical injustice. This is the whole purpose of existence, that a person is going to be prevented from serving God. That's where the Jew comes in. That's Vayakam Datze, and what as a result of this, what did he achieve? Vayoshion. This was a Yeshua. This was a salvation. He saved them. He saved them not from having to get water again. He saved them from the degradation of idolatry and gave them the ability to serve God. That's they came back and said, he saved us. He saved us because this is a true saving. And these are the points. These are the qualities of the great Jewish leader in combination with that tremendous humbleness. The fact of the matter is that he did not think very much of himself, that he was the humblest of all people, and that is the truest, the most significant quality that determines his the capability of being a leader.